Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 6, Chapter 4, the Hamsa Guhya Prayers, Text 8. Aho Prajapati Pati Bhagavan Hare Avyaya Naspatim Oshadishcha Sar Georgiam Isham Vibhu. Translation: the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Hari, is the master of all living entities, including all the Prajapatis, such as Lord Brahma. Because he is the all-pervading and indestructible master, he has created all these trees and vegetables as eatables for other living entities. Purport. Soma, the predominating deity of the moon, reminded the Pratetas that this vegetation has been created by the Lord of Lords to provide food for everyone. If the Pratetas tried to kill them off, their own subjects would also suffer, for trees are also required for food. Om Ganatirmadandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshurmilitam Hena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namah. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasani Gaurabhaktavrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Prachit Maharaj begins this chapter by asking Shukadev Goswami to kindly elaborate on a topic he spoke briefly of in the third canto. That is the secondary creation initiated by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Bhagavan Hari, but carried out by others. So Prachit Maharaj wants some more details. Now you may be thinking, haven't we had enough discussion of creation already? Let's get on with the leelas. That is a mistaken approach to Srimad Bhagavatam. And just to make sure you understand what's going on and how, as Sanatan Goswami explains, every syllable of Bhagavatam is saturated with Krishna brain. Just to make sure you understand that, Shukadev Goswami is pleased by Prachit Maharaj's inquiry. He praises Prachit Maharaj's inquiry. And that way we understand that a real devotee is concerned with all aspects of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and his activities, his creations, everything Krishna does is relished by a devotee. Of course, it is also true that in our purified state, in our natural position, every devotee has a particular taste for Krishna's pastimes. And of course, it may not even be Krishna's pastimes. There are devotees of Vaikuntha. There are devotees of Ram. But we are followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And that generally means that the taste is for the pastimes of Krishna, the pastimes of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So, we were speaking Friday night, how Srila Prabhupada's books are one-stop shopping because they have everything in them for all levels of devotees. That is how he explained his books to us in Los Angeles during the BBT days in the 70s. He said that his books are like a chemist or a pharmacy, which has prescriptions for all kinds of persons. So he explained that his books have everything in them for the neophyte devotee as well as for the most advanced Mahabhagavat. And as you make spiritual development, you'll see more and more the contents of these books. What you see depends on what your consciousness is. Because As I often point out, Vedic knowledge is state-specific. It depends on your level of consciousness. So this principle is totally in opposition to the Western concept, which is that your quality of consciousness, your behavior, has nothing to do with what you can learn. You can just be a complete debauch, degraded, whatever, and do all the activities that are so relished and appreciated by the people in general today. You can do all that, and it actually has no effect on your intellect and your ability to understand the complexities of the universe, the complexities of a human psyche. In fact, things are so disgusting these days that people think the more you engage in these abominable activities, the sharper you are. And those who tried to control their mind and senses are repressed and pent up, and therefore they're malfunctioning. They're not full human beings. They're not able to fully appreciate the gamut of the cosmic experience. So these two principles are in opposition. Knowledge is state-specific, and knowledge has nothing to do with your consciousness, especially because we don't have much idea what is consciousness anyway. Bhagavatam understanding depends on pleasing the Bhagavat, the person devotee. And the more that one renders service to the person Bhagavat, the more the contents of the Bhagavat become realized. So it is very special, and you should take note, that Shukadeva Goswami is described here by Sutta Goswami. He says about Shukadeva, and he's telling the sages assembled at Naimisharanya, that the great yogi Shukadeva Goswami, Mahayogi, heard King Pritchett's inquiry and praised the inquiry. So, Shukadeva Goswami's not saying, why are you asking me this? I talked about it briefly in the third canto, let's get on with the tenth canto. No, he's encouraging you and clarifying the situation for you. That everything that the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Bhagavan Hari, does is appreciated by the devotee, while simultaneously, in the most advanced stages of bhakti, a devotee has his particular taste. The example commonly given by the acharyas is in a relationship, a family relationship, now let's say husband and wife, if they're getting along, they appreciate all the activities of the spouse. At the same time, there are some activities that are particularly attractive. So similarly, we appreciate everything that Krishna does and everything that Srimad Bhagavatam explains. And as we become more advanced, we'll be able to see how every syllable of the Bhagavatam increases our love of Krishna. So what is the situation that we have here? The Prachetas, who is their father? King Prachinabharhi. He's the one that got the famous Pranjana allegory from Narada Muni. He heard that whole allegory that takes up a big chunk of the fourth canto. And as a result of his hearing that Pranjana allegory, the story of one who tries to enjoy within the body, Pranjana, King Prachinabharhi left for the forest. In other words, the proof that you have wisdom is action. This is why Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita that knowledge is nothing passive, it's not static, it's not inactive. It does things. That's why Krishna describes in Bhagavad Gita that the fire of transcendental knowledge burns. There's nothing theoretical about fire burning. And Krishna also describes that When you are situated in the boat of transcendental knowledge, you can cross over the miseries of material existence. So that's, again, that is nothing theoretical. A boat, transport, takes you places. The kind of knowledge that Krishna is speaking about in Bhagavad Gita does things for you. If you've properly heard it, and in order to properly hear that knowledge, we render service, as stated in the first canto of Bhagavatam. Vasudeva Kataruchi Sanma Sevaya Vipra. By rendering service to the great soul, you get the ruchi, the taste for the Vasudeva Kata, the talks about Vasudeva Bhagavan Hari. Now, how does this make sense to mundane calculation? By serving someone, I can understand something better? What does seva have to do with my understanding? In fact, if I compete with that person who's teaching me and eventually take their post, then I'll understand better. That is the mundane understanding. So in this way, bhakti is mysterious. It's confidential because it seems to be so contrary to our mundane experience. Actually, though, our mundane experience has some relation to the spiritual reality. It's, as you know, a perversion of the spiritual reality. But we're so caught up in being the controller and enjoyer that we don't see the distortion and the origin of the distortion. We just take the distortion, the perversion, so seriously that we cannot lift our heads above the mud, so to speak, and see that there is a pure reality that is the basis of the distortion. We take the distortion, the perversion, as all important, crucial. And therefore you see human beings today so wrapped up in trying to sort out problems that they themselves have created because of ignoring the spiritual reality, janmadiyasitaha, the absolute truth from which everything emanates. You ignore Bhagavan Hari and his energies. You set up your own business, so to speak, which is nothing but problems. You can't see. You've created your own problems because of a deviation in your constitutional activities. You've deviated from your constitutional activities. So here, we're going to see that there's been some excesses that have to be corrected. First of all, the earth is without proper leadership, because after Narada Muni spoke to Prachinabarhi, Prachinabarhi left for the forest. In other words, he showed that he really heard. Just like when Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, idam tu te guyatamam pravaksham yanasuyave gyanam vigyanasaitam yajgata mokshase shubha. He says, Arjuna, I'm going to teach you confidential knowledge, knowing which you'll be freed from material existence. I'm going to teach you both wisdom and the spiritual technology for applying that wisdom. Because you have the right state of mind, the right state of consciousness, you're in harmony with me. Therefore, I'm going to teach you and you'll be able to understand because of your state of consciousness. You're going to understand. And how do we know that you understand? We're going to see that you become free from material existence, from all the inauspicious situations that characterize material existence. Now, why is it that we may have a little difficulty seeing that the entire spectrum of material existence is inauspicious? It's hard for us to see the whole picture as inauspicious because we are attached to material enjoyment. So therefore, we just catch yourself. In your mind, you're thinking, well, there's some aspects of material life that are very depressing and bad, but there are other aspects which... Well... We make that false discrimination. Lord Chaitanya calls it Manodharma, the university of mental speculation. You look into an inauspicious situation and you falsely distinguish and discriminate. Oh, this is good inauspiciousness, and that is inauspiciousness to be rejected. Whereas the standpoint of Bhagavatam is that it's all to be rejected in terms of our using the material energy for our own enjoyment. Because we're attached to certain aspects of material existence, we make a false distinction. That's why Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita that someone who is actually realized doesn't distinguish between pebbles and gold. In other words, the person obviously knows that gold has a price and pebbles don't. Unless you're trying to, you have a dirt road at your house and you're trying to put some stones down. Still, the value of the stones, the pebbles, in no way equals the value of gold. So what does Krishna mean? He means that someone who's actually realized doesn't distinguish based on their own sense gratification. They just judge based on what is appropriate for Krishna's service, what has value for Krishna's service. Sometimes for Krishna's service, pebbles have value. Sometimes for Krishna's service, gold has value. So the realized person sees everything in the material world in terms of how can it be used in Krishna's service, what has value for Krishna's pleasure. Therefore, the bhakti yogi is saved from this monodharma, this university of mental speculation in which you falsely assign values to various ingredients of material nature based on your sense gratification. So again, let's think. Because we are attached to various aspects of material existence, we don't dismiss the entire package of material existence as inauspicious. We don't get the full impact when Krishna says to Arjuna, Yajgatra Moksha Se Ashubhat, you'll be free from the whole inauspicious package. We can see this false distinction and Lord Chaitanya's reaction to it. That false distinction based on our attachments to certain aspects of material nature. Lord Chaitanya is speaking to the future Raghunath Das Goswami, who has just left home. Now, the home of Raghunath Das Goswami was not only super wealthy, but his parents and uncles were pious indeed. They were supportive of Vaishnava culture. They were more than pious. They were actually supporting the Brahmanas, supporting the Vaishnavas, so much so that they could have a gathering at their home, a symposium to discuss the holy name, and Haridas Thakur would come and preside. They used their wealth to support bhakti activities. Yet, Lord Chaitanya, you must understand, he's from the spiritual world. And he's showing us what is the spiritual reality and what is the material reality. He's showing that to us very clearly. It's a lesson we really need to understand, especially in the age of Kali. And Lord Chaitanya's Kali Yuga Pavana, he's the deliverer of the living entities from Kali Yuga. So you would think that he would be very praised, he would praise very much the family of Raghunath Das. Oh, your father, your uncle, using wealth in Krishna's service, supporting Brahminical culture, and you come from such a home. What did Lord Chaitanya say? Krishna has saved you from a most hellish situation. You're like a worm that's been plucked out of the stool. For years I've been thinking about this section. What's going on here? I mean, compared to the persons of today, Raghunath Das's father and uncle, they were like saintly sadhus. But Lord Chaitanya is making a critical distinction. It's not that, of course, Lord Chaitanya had aversion to Raghunath Das's family or rejected the family, but still, this is Chaitanya Charitamrita, which is giving you the highest perspective in all of existence. Lord Chaitanya explained that the uncle and father of Raghunath Das, although they're supportive of Vaishnav culture, they're attached to their enjoyment and their comforts. That's what Lord Chaitanya was honing in on. Yes, in other words, I know they're big donors. I know they've contributed hugely to the temple fund. But if you don't mind my saying so, they're attached to material enjoyment and comforts. Therefore, they cannot be considered, in the strict sense, they cannot be considered to be solid devotees, solid Vaishnavas. And then Lord Chaitanya became very graphic. And for many decades, I've been wondering about this graphic description. Lord Chaitanya compared the situation that Raghunath Das came out of to be like the stool that a worm is plucked out of. Yeah, I thought, this is kind of, is this a bit over the top? But finally I began to think, what's going on here? There's a very important principle that may take us a while to understand in bhakti. But if you can see your way to it, you'll save yourself so much trouble. Lord Chaitanya, and Prabhupada explains further in the purport, is pointing out that when you are attached to material enjoyment, simultaneously, whether you know it or not, you're also attached to so many miserable conditions. The two come together. But we don't see it like that, right? We see, well, over here is material enjoyment, and over there are the miserable conditions. We, in our minds, have it all figured out, that we're going to have material enjoyment and we'll avoid the miserable conditions. Or we'll have material enjoyment and, yeah, sometimes there are miserable conditions and you just tolerate, you know, while getting the material enjoyment. This is our crazy concept. We think we've got it all figured out. So what Lord Chaitanya is trying to teach us with that graphic example of the worm and stool is that the worm has a taste for certain flavors in that situation. No need for us to go deep into that. The worm is relishing a particular rasa, a particular flavor. Therefore, the worm doesn't mind where he is. He takes it all as part and parcel of the situation. And so therefore, Srila Prabhupada points out, if you pull the worm out of that stuff, the worm will crawl right back in. Why? Because the worm is attached to those flavors. So therefore the worm doesn't think, well, look where I am. The worm just thinks, the flavor, the flavor, the flavor. And because I'm after the flavor, the situation's all part of it, you know? So it took me many decades to sort this one out. And then it hit me. Wow. Amazing. The attachment to those material flavors blinds you to your situation. That's why you see people today just taking things in stride as normal. Yeah, you gotta take the good with the bad, you know, ride the waves of life, roll with the punches, you know. That's the way it is, you know? You can't have all good. In fact, you need bad times to help you appreciate the good times. Maybe some of you have rationalized in that way. Yeah. The bad times help you to enjoy better. Without the bad times, how would you really appreciate the good times? This perverted, distorted mentality is all about our attachment. In other words, our knowledge faculties have been destroyed by attachment. Therefore, we can't understand that by my attachment to material enjoyment, I've agreed to accept so many inauspicious situations. It's all part and parcel of the same thing, but we don't see it like that. Once again, what's our defective vision? Over here is material enjoyment, and over here are the material miseries. Somehow, in my quest to enjoy, I get a little bit of misery, sometimes a lot of misery, but, you know, that's the way it is, you know? It doesn't have to be like that, because I know one day I'm just going to have pure material enjoyment. Just for a few moments. Oh, how great it will be. Just for a day, for a night, pure material enjoyment. I don't mind that I have to go through so many tough situations. So you actually, in your quest for material enjoyment, sign on the dotted line, yes, also give me material distress. But we don't see it like that. It takes a while to understand this, that by my attempt to materially enjoy, I'm also bringing upon myself miserable conditions. Just think about it. You can say it, but to actually have that impact hit you in your face. Oh. It's actually quite revolutionary. The more I try to materially enjoy, the more miseries I'm bringing upon myself. That's the story of Kali Yuga, because there's practically no piety in Kali Yuga. The attempt to enjoy is of the lowest nature, and therefore the reactions are the most oppressive. So Lord Chaitanya made a very graphic presentation to Raghunath Das Gosa. This is where you've come from. You're a worm who's escaped from that stuff. Lord Chaitanya is from the spiritual world. Golokera Premadana Harinam Sankirtana. He's brought the Harinam Sankirtan from the spiritual world. I remember once Srila Prabhupada, 1977, was talking with some devotees. And he was explaining about the need for Varnashram Dharma. And so the devotees, they were a little confused. But they said to Prabhupada, didn't Lord Chaitanya say that Varnashram Dharma is external? And what was Prabhupada's response? Oh, Lord Chaitanya is from the spiritual world. We are different. We are different. We want to help people in this way. He's from the spiritual world. So in his discussion with Raghunath Das, you can see that. Like I said, instead of glorifying Raghunath Das's uncle and father, oh, they're giving much money, big donors to the temple, having meetings, bhakti vriksha at their house. He said, they're attached to comfort and material enjoyment. Wow, doing a bit of seva. But the real thing is they're attached. So please think about this point. Because of my attachment to material enjoyment, I accept so many inauspicious situations. I don't even see it. I don't see those situations. I take it as normal. But once you hone in on that desire to materially enjoy and analyze it through the lens of the Bhagavatam, you start to see, I voluntarily signed up for so much complexity, so much stress, so much anxiety. Why? Because I want certain things from material nature. King Prachinabarhi heard Narada Muni's explanation of Paranjana, and he showed that he heard by action. Because, as we said, the fire of transcendental knowledge burns. Transcendental knowledge is a boat that takes you places. So Prachinabarhi left for the forest. Fine, well and good. Meanwhile, where's the government? You say, well, Prachinabarhi had sons. But you see, before Prachinabarhi left for the forest, his sons had already gone underwater to perform austerities. Prachinabarhi didn't wait for them to return. He heard from Narada Muni, knew that he had to perfect his life, and left for the forest. So now, there's no government in the world. The sons, the Prachetas, they're underwater doing austerities because they know in order to be proper human beings, able to give leadership, able to have good families, we need to perform some austerities. So they're doing that. So while they're underwater and their father, King Prachinabarhi, is gone to the forest, the whole earth planet becomes overwhelmed with trees and weeds and uncontrolled vegetation. Because there's no government to clarify the situation. There's chaos. Today you have governments, but because they don't know what to do, they cause chaos everywhere. So the Prachetas came out from the water. And they saw, what is this? What's happened to the earth? It's just covered with uncontrolled vegetation. Their response was anger. Try to understand that anger. Those who have a managemental propensity get angry when they see chaos. What is this? Who's organizing here? Who's managing? Where's the management? What is this nonsense? Those who have a brahminical tendency, they get angry when they hear about a philosophical deviation or some deviation from proper achar, Vaishnava behavior. Who is allowing these impurities to go on? So, in this way, try to understand the anger of the Prachetas. At the same time, there's some subtle points about their anger, and the Bhagavatam is letting you see that. It's stated that they had undergone long austerities in the water. Because of those long austerities, they had anger. In other words, their anger is really not the proper thing. And the anger arose because of the kind of austerities they were doing. Therefore, they decided they're going to burn all the vegetation on the earth by their mystic power. And their mystic power is the result of their austerities. So they were able to generate wind and fire from their mouths. We see something very interesting, among so many interesting things, in the purport, where Srila Prabhupada explains that a Vaishnava's result of austerity is forgiveness. It's a cautioning note for us that we shouldn't be so quick to jump on a high horse and get angry at others based on our prowess, based on our dedication to devotional service. The actual proper result of all that is forgiveness. So Prabhupada writes that although devotees undergo severe tapasya, however, they are vimanyava sadhava, which means they are never angry. They're always decorated with good qualities. Bhagavatam states tatikshava karunika suhuda saradehinam ajata shakshava shanta sadhava sadhubhushana. A sadhu, a devotee, is never angry. Actually, the real features of devotees who undergo tapasya, austerity, is forgiveness. So we want to see, as we develop in our bhakti, we want to see that forgiveness there. Not that since I have served Krishna for so long, I have a right to be angry. There are special occasions, though, where the anger of a devotee is a legitimate response. That's part of the emotional makeup of a devotee. This is explained by Narottam Das Thakur. How you can use all aspects, all emotional aspects of your being in Krishna's service. He says, even lust. Yes, lust to use everything in Krishna's service. Kama Krishna Karmarpana. Bhakti is all about intense desire, intense hankering. And Narottam Das Thakur says, you can use anger when Krishna or Krishna's devotee is offended. That's the proper use of anger. Don't just take it sitting down. Oh, well, you know. According to Shastra, that situation is the proper use for anger. But overall, a Vaishnav is forgiving. And, well, let's speak frankly about our devotees and their interactions. Sometimes they have a very difficult time to forgive. You have offended me. I'm a devotee. How could you do this? You have misunderstood me. You have failed to appreciate my glories. You've minimized me. You've overlooked me. And we get really bent out of shape, as they say. I have seen so many cases of devotees who were either truly mistreated or to their mind they were mistreated. And decades later, it's like yesterday for them. I have a few godbrothers who, during the difficult times in ISKCON in the 80s, they went through some tough situations. After all, the Shastra does explain in the fourth canto of Bhagavatam, the purports explain that after the departure of an extraordinary acharya, you should expect that there are going to be upheavals. It's impersonal not to expect that. In other words, because the person was so great, in the departure of that person, there's a great, something's missing, and therefore things are unsettled for a while. So yes, during the 80s there were commotions because Prabhupada's disciples were so young and all they knew was him, and now they were going to have to carry on things without his physical presence. So it was very austere. And some devotees couldn't get over how they were not dealt with properly. And I know some of them. I see them today, and they talk to me about what happened in the mid-80s. It was about 30 years ago? Almost 30 years ago. They talk about it like it was yesterday. And they even tell me, how can you just act like this didn't happen? You should be affected. You should be angry. You should be, otherwise you're living in denial. I said, well, I'm not excusing what happened, but at the same time, I have to consider that what was my contribution to the problem, conscious or unconscious? This is Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's principle, that the only reason I see a fault in others is what? I have it thousands of times more in me, therefore I'm the world's expert in the fault. That's why I see it in you, because I know I've got it hugely in me. So I said, that's point number one. Whether I was conscious of it or not, no doubt I contributed to the problem. And point number two, no matter how severe a situation gets, a devotee cannot give up his devotional service, her devotional service. I have seen so many devotees who tried to do some outreach, tried to take up some challenge for Krishna, tried to dedicate themselves fully, sacrificing, and then because there was some bump in the road, And it's natural that in a society of devotees, because not everyone is on the same level of purity, sometimes there's commotion, misunderstanding, abrasiveness. It shouldn't be there, but when you understand ISKCON is a hospital, then you can see that patients have different levels of following the doctor's instruction. So therefore, in a hospital, sometimes germs are there, but the expert medical staff is always sterilizing the place, combating the germs, because you've got patients in the hospital. Well, people don't go to a hospital. So sometimes there'll be misunderstandings and commotions amongst devotees. We're not utopians, as Srila Prabhupada once commented. We're not pie-in-the-sky dreaming. You know, we know that you're dealing with human nature. Sometimes, you know, things get a bit out of hand, misunderstandings, lack of appreciation. Just think in your own devotional life. I'm sure you can come up with some incident where someone spoke to you too strongly, someone, they denied you your due, right? Think about it. You know of some situation which could have been handled better. It's always going to happen. But if we're intent on going back to Godhead, we never give up our service. That attitude is nearing what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says in the eighth prayer of Shikshashtaka. Krishna, there may be situations in which I'm handled roughly, but you're my worshipful Lord unconditionally, meaning I'll never give up my service. Sometimes there are challenges. And indeed, sometimes Krishna can test you. Krishna wants to see what you're really made of. Are you just a fair weather devotee? Summertime devotee? Now you may say, why should Krishna test us? I mean, we've got a tough time as it is being in the material world, you know? But you see, Krishna is the supreme expert in love. He knows how to get the best love out of living entities. So don't begrudge Krishna. Don't think, Krishna, what are you doing? Do you really understand, I mean, what's happening to me? I mean, look at my situation. Look what I'm going through. And I did service for you. I didn't simply give, like Raghunath Das's relatives. I didn't simply give donations. I did service, humble service. And now look, what is this? Why are you doing this to me? All over the world I find devotees who have this syndrome. My godbrothers, younger devotees, lumps in the heart. You go on, you know, chanting, you go on trying to do your practical service, but there's a lump in the heart. Why did that happen? Every devotee is going to have to deal with this because we're getting over our conditioned nature and we're nearing the platform that Lord Chaitanya talks about in Shikshashtra. Mama janmani janmani shvade bhavatad bhakti hoitigi tvai. I don't mind birth after birth as long as I have devotional service to your lotus feet. So Krishna knows how to bring out that pure devotion. He's the expert. But yet, we forget that and we get an attitude. Krishna, how could you let this happen to me? Look at my health. Look at my finances. Look at my family situation. Where's the girl of my dreams? Where's the man of my dreams? Where is my child who is automatically Prahlad Maharaj? If we actually understand Bhagavan Hari in his most personal dealings, then we can see that Krishna knows how to love. He's the expert. Just ask the residents of Vrindavan. Even when the Brijbasis accuse Krishna, and the gopis would accuse him, Look what you've done. We have given up family. We've given up our honor. We've given up our social respect. We've thrown it all away for you, and then you left. Simply giving us some tricky words that, I'm sorry, I cannot repay you. Be satisfied with your service. So even though these dearmost devotees of Krishna talk about giving up Krishna, if they even say, if he can be happy with the city girls in Dwarka and Mathura, why then should we not be happy without him? He can be happy without us, we'll be happy without him. And they exhort one another, they counsel one another. We should stop talking about Krishna. We should just forget him. Yes, yes, I agree. We should stop talking about Krishna. What do you think? Yes, we should stop talking about Krishna. Right. Yes, we should give up Krishna. We should never mention Krishna. We should stop talking about him. Give him up. What do we have to, why do we have to think about him? Let's just cut ourselves off from him. Yes, no more Krishna. That's right. We should not speak any more about Krishna. It just goes on and on and on. The reality is, not for a split second can they separate themselves from Krishna, even when they talk about it. Now, what kind of love is that? Have you seen that kind of love in the material world? That's what Lord Chaitanya is talking about in the eighth prayer of the Shikshastaka. So, we want to approach that platform in our humble way. And therefore, we have to learn to trust Krishna. And part of trusting Krishna is to forgive. Sometimes the Hare Krishnas, you know, they get very quick to jump on a high horse and ride, you know? Prabhu, this is what should be done. We're very quick to do that. And we can also be very quick to put down others. You're not doing this. If you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. But as we truly advance in bhakti, forgiveness should become more and more manifest. Now, of course, sometimes correction has to be there. And if it's your devotional service to correct, you have to do that service, and it is difficult. I can speak from my own experience as a GBC. It's very difficult to have to tell a Prabhu, now, you can't really do that, and I think that's gone a bit too far. It's very difficult. I mean, sometimes I think, maybe I should just go open up a preaching center in northern Laos or something. This is very difficult because, you know, naturally you want just let everything happen, whatever. Okay, you want to do things that way? Fine. You want to do things that way? Great. Well, whatever. You know, how do you follow Prabhu? Don't you love me? But there has to be an ultimate authority. And please understand, it is not an easy task. And certainly, as the GBCs get older, we're looking for others to pass this nectarian seva on to. I remember, since we're talking, it was in the 90s, and I was in Mayapur. One of my godbrothers, Solanus Shivaramaraj, came up to me and said, you know, you look too happy. You should be a GBC. So then, I didn't think anything of that. So, about a month later, I had a very vivid dream of Srila Prabhupada. And he came up to me and he held out a Bhagavatam. I was like, wow, a new Bhagavatam of Bhaktivedanta purports. Maybe it's more of the 10th canto. He held out the Bhagavatam. And so I went, and then he took the Bhagavatam, GBC. He stuck the book behind his back and said, So my point in explaining that is to say that, yes, sometimes it's your service to have to make judgments, discriminations, draw the line, and it's nothing you relish. You might think, oh boy, if I were the authority, I'd sort everyone out. Very difficult. It's excruciating. Dealing with senior devotees also. Sorry, Maharaj, but you know, I feel like a traffic cop or something. Not this road, Swami. On the road, please. And you know what they're thinking sometimes, like, who are you to say this, you know? And just let the preaching go on and be quiet. And so it's very difficult. But if it's your service, then you do it as a service to Krishna. Therefore, parents are entrusted with the service of correcting their children. Gurus are entrusted with the service of correcting their disciples. And those with spiritual responsibilities, they have that duty to give directives. So that's another thing. And of course, there shouldn't be anger. Unless you are completely sure that your anger is 100% for Krishna's service. Otherwise, be very careful. And better we focus on forgiveness. Because this is what I see hangs up so many devotees. They can't forgive. I'm a devotee. How could you have done this to me? Me! Remember 15 years ago? One devotee in South Africa was telling me how 10 years ago, when his Guru Maharaj came and they had their Vyasa Puja for their Guru Maharaj, and the temple president, who's also a disciple of the Guru Maharaj, he didn't call this devotee to make his offering. And this devotee, I'm one of the senior disciples, why didn't he call me? 10 years later, this was still eating away at him. Now you could say, certainly it seems from the circumstances you should have been called to make your offering in the public before everyone. But why is this eating your heart out 10 years later? We can all find things like that, yes? So forgiveness is very essential. And the Prachetas are getting out of hand. They're desiring to burn all the vegetation with their mystic power. The mystic power is the result of their austerities. So now what happens? Soma, who is in charge of trees and vegetation, he's also in charge of the moon, he saw this destruction, and he especially felt sympathy because he's actually the maintainer of all the trees and herbs and so forth. So he sought to appease the anger of the Prachetas. And he's speaking. Now notice how he starts. He says, O Mahabhaga, O greatly fortunate ones. You're supposed to be the protectors of all living entities. So first he compliments them. You're greatly fortunate, Mahabhaga. He reminds them of their duty. You're supposed to be the protector of all living entities. You're the government. You don't just protect human beings. You protect all species of life. And then he makes reference to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Supreme Absolute Truth, Bhagavan Hari. And that's today's verse. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Hari, is the master of all living entities, including all the Prajapatis, such as Lord Brahma, because he is the all-pervading and indestructible master. He has created all these trees and vegetables as eatables for other living entities. So Soma is pointing out that there is someone ultimately in charge, and that person ultimately in charge, Bhagavan Hari, is indestructible, all-pervading. This is a very important point that Bhagavatam keeps hitting you with, because you'll find, if you're doing outreach and talking to those who know nothing about Krishna, or to speak of know nothing about theism, they cannot get it in their heads how the Supreme Absolute Truth can be an individual person and at the same time all-pervading. This is what you're declaring. You're declaring when you say Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. You are declaring that the Supreme Absolute Truth is all-pervading and is at the same time a person. How can that be? Generally, the average person thinks person means contained, limited. That's it. Not outside those boundaries. But a person who's simultaneously all-pervading? That cannot be understood by material intelligence. Achincha Beda Beda Tattva. How Krishna is one with his energies and still different from them at the same time cannot be understood by material intelligence. This mystery can only be entered into by bhakti, devotional service. Otherwise, how does your mundane intellect work if you're trying to deal with Achincha Beda Beda Tattva? You go one side or the other side. Krishna is the same as everything. Krishna is different from everything. But simultaneously, both together, the mundane intellect can't handle that. That's why it's called achincha, inconceivable. But through the bhakti process, things become clearer to you. So the prachetas are pointing out that there is a supreme in charge, and that supreme has created all these trees and vegetables as food for other living entities. So if you destroy the food supply, how are you going to protect the people, the other living entities who are supposed to eat the trees and veggies? What to speak of, how are you going to protect the trees and veggies? You're causing wholesale environmental destruction. Just look at the situation today. In the name of economic progress, human beings have destroyed the earth. And they can't go on like this, but they can't stop. The earth cannot handle the present rate of resource exploitation, nor can the earth handle all the waste that have been generated. There's not enough resources for society to go on as it is now, and there's not enough space to dispose of the waste. But who can stop? So in this way, human beings have become, for the first time in known human history, they become a geophysical force capable of making massive geological changes, geophysical changes on the Earth planet. For the first time in known human history. But then you see the prachetas in another yuga. They had that ability through their mystic power. They could burn all the vegetation on the whole planet. So you might consider what the prachetas were doing as mythology. But just think, if the prachetas hear about what human beings are doing today, such destruction, they would think, impossible, this must be mythology. How could anyone live like that? Finally, we'll discuss some principles about food given in the Bhaktivedanta purports. The principle for Krishna's maintenance of all living entities is that as soon as a living entity takes birth, there is a preordained arrangement for that living entity to get the food it requires. That's the way material nature works. So any disturbance to that arrangement is made by human beings who have distorted intelligence, because there's already a prior arrangement. As soon as a creature takes birth, the food supply for that creature is there. So what disrupts this arrangement? Number one, mismanagement. And number two, the criminal behavior of human beings who violate Dharma, that criminal behavior causes nature, and nature means its controllers, to restrict the food supply. Although there's already a prior arrangement to give all living entities their due food supply, because of the misbehavior, nature restricts the supply. So the restriction of the supply of food is after the fact, so to speak. First there's an arrangement. Then, but you're acting so crazy, therefore the supply must be restricted. Not only are you acting so crazy in terms of your behavior, but you're mismanaging. So therefore, there's a food problem, and living entities are human beings we're speaking of there. They feel that it's such an ordeal how to feed the world's population. I'll give you some statistics. This one is from the Institute of Mechanical Engineers, international organization based in the UK, which is the Sangha, the association of all the mechanical engineers in the world. They have calculated that the world produces 4 billion metric tons of food a year, and between 30 to 50% of that is wasted. Between 1.2 billion metric tons and 2 billion metric tons is wasted. How? Wasted at the time of harvest. Wasted because of transport. Wasted in distribution. And wasted at the retail end. Just like it's been calculated in the UK, that 30% of all the veggies grown in the UK are wasted because the veggies don't look good to customer eyes. So they throw them away. They don't look good enough for the supermarket, even though they're perfectly fine veggies. 30% just thrown out by the growers. So again, you see this mismanagement. Let's look at obesity and starvation. The statistics show that there are 1 billion people in the world who are not getting enough food. And don't be surprised, there are 1 billion people in the world who have obesity problems. So you might say, well, who are you to decide that I'm eating too much? I can do what I like. But the laws of nature take care of all these things. You cannot manage properly. You cannot control your senses. Therefore, there's going to be restriction. Although there is arrangement so that everyone can have the food supply they need, you're destroying that arrangement. You're causing your own problems. And therefore, besides the problems you've created by your mismanagement, the laws of nature are going to cause you further problems in response to your criminal mentality by restricting the food supply. So it's all on you. Soma is asking the Pratetas, take into account protection. You have to act responsibly. Not only as the government are you responsible for giving protection, but you're also responsible for making sure those who have duties of protection do those duties. That means, as a government, you're responsible to see that parents are protecting their children, family members protecting their family members, teachers are giving proper protection to their students, gurus are giving proper protection to their disciples. So not only as a government do you give protection, but you also supervise the protection that the protectors are giving to their dependents. So in this way, we get a completely different vision of how the world is supposed to run. And we may think, well, these lessons are coming to us through something that looks like mythology to me. But again, remember, our current situation is so degraded and crazy that a sane person from another yuga hearing about it would think, mythology, it's impossible that people could live like that. Hmm. So these are some insights that we can get from this section of Srimad Bhagavatam. We can understand the need for dependency on counsel and guidance. Soma is the counselor, the mentor. He's saying, look, there's something going on bigger than what you can see. I think you ought to control your senses. I think you ought to curb your anger. I think you ought to forgive. Let's move on, because you have a role to play. You must give protection, and you must supervise the protectors who are giving protection. All right. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.